The 1996 Einstein Symposium presents session number 255, Mugged by Reality, a paper by Gary Watts, with comments by Scott Abbott.
It is definitely fun to look out there and see the alohas and other friendly gestures people have made to each other who haven't seen each other for a year or so. It's fun to observe that. I'd like to welcome everybody to this session, which is Mugged by Reality. Dr. Gary Watts is going to be speaking this, and he's promised he wouldn't mug any of us on the way out. Dr. Watts received his undergraduate at the University of USU, Utah State University, and his medical degree at U of U. His internship was spent at in the LA area. He is a doctor of radiology and nuclear medicine. He works down at the Regional Medical Center. I knew I was leaving something now. But even more important, Gary and Millie, his wife, if you know these people, you immediately fall in love with them. They have done a tremendous service in the area of family fellowship. Family fellowship is a support group for gay and lesbian parents, friends, or gays and lesbians, as far as that goes, that is very active in Idaho, Utah, and hopefully eventually other places in the United States. It's kind of what I refer to as the Mormon P flag. Gary is a very dominant force. He's gone through a lot of interesting experiences, including getting mugged by reality a couple of times, and he'll be presenting the paper. Unfortunately, Scott Abbott, who was going to present some remarks about Gary's paper, was not able to be here due to the change of scheduling, and so he's asked me to read his paper, and after Gary gets through, I will. So without any further ado, we'll turn it over to Gary.
Good afternoon. It's an honor for me to be able to address you this afternoon. I think I will pretty much stay to the text that I have prepared, and I hope you'll bear with me. I think it's about 40 minutes in length, so hunker down, and I hope you're all awake after the luncheon and will be able to stay with me. My sentinel experience with homosexuality dates back to December of 1989. It was in the evening when our then 23-year-old son, Craig, found the courage to confide in us that he was homosexual. I remember that night vividly. It caught me by complete surprise. At times, it seems like just yesterday. Other times, it seems like an eternity. Through the tears, he said, "I've been trying for several years to get rid of these feelings without success. I feel like I have cancer or cerebral palsy or some incurable disease." So began our incredible journey. Here we are, 7 years later at Sunstone, sharing our experience, still trying to understand. The common thread that has kept us going, motivated our study, and helped us persevere has been our strong faith in the inherent goodness of our son. The reality of his life and the integrity in dealing openly and honestly with his same-sex attraction has literally altered our worldview and opened vistas of thought and action that would have been impossible otherwise. I want to share with you some excerpts from a letter he wrote to his sister Becky in 1992 as a prelude to my remarks about the morality of homosexuality. My goals in sharing these thoughts are twofold. First, I'm hopeful they will be educational. And second, I think it appropriate for those listening to know my own experience and bias. Dear Becky, when you called me on Christmas Eve, I had a chance to talk to Dad alone for a few minutes. He asked whether I wanted him to tell you that I'm gay. My only option at that point would have been to have told you myself amidst all that holiday cheer. I just didn't feel like pouring out my soul, recounting my own horror, disgust, and agony. I have done enough of that, and it isn't doing anyone a favor. The truth is really quite simple. I fall in love with men rather than women, and I always have, and there are and have always been people like me. From my point of view, which may differ greatly from yours, which is part of the reason I hesitated to tell you, the problem is not in me. I certainly didn't choose this. But in a culture that refuses to get information or look at hard facts that exist in the world. It all started a long time ago. I always felt different from everyone else. I had a string of crushes, mostly on teachers, all through high school. When friends started making out, I couldn't understand what or why they were doing that. But the bewilderment soon gave way to anxiety because being different is dangerous in high school. And I didn't want to be different, but I didn't want to kiss girls either. I forced myself to kiss my date after the junior prom to see if some magical transformation might take place. Nothing. Anxiety built again until I gave it another try, bumping teeth, a very awkward attempt at a kiss, with my date after the senior dinner dance. At about the time I graduated, Dr. Ruth, of all people, ushered me into the realm of knowing. A caller asked what it meant that his man friend had sexual fantasies that involved only other men. Dr. Ruth wisely suggested, "Perhaps your friend is gay." An electric shock went through my body, and I knew perfectly that I was gay. The problem was that the only gay people I had seen were reprobate losers with greasy hair, no shirts, marching around San Francisco obnoxiously. I was not one of them, but I was. I am. There are lots of us, all kinds of us. We're everywhere, even sleepy old Provo. I didn't know anyone else who was gay, and I would die before telling anyone. I still thought of it as wrong, as a disease I needed to be cured of. I went on a mission in part to try to get over it without telling a soul. A year after my mission, I told Mom and Dad, went to psychiatrists, worried. Slowly I told my friends and collected my self-esteem. Now I don't cry anymore when I tell people. I don't think of it as the worst thing in the world I could possibly tell someone about myself. I think of it as just one more of the quirks in life that we never finish bumping up against. I think it's a shame that sexuality is so hushed up in Mormon culture. I went through a lot of misery that could have been avoided. I worry about the others like me who are stuck there now, unable to tell anyone. That is the most perfect state of loneliness. Perhaps contemplating suicide or marriage as the only way out. Texas is probably a lot like Utah. Ignorance equals fear equals hate. I want people to know, to challenge them to think about homosexuality as an issue that has been shunned, silenced, misunderstood, feared. I can't expect you to automatically agree with me and accept the fact that I fall in love with men, but I do expect to hear more about your opinion and expect information on it. I'm afraid Mike would disapprove, but I want him to know. This discussion is to be continued, I hope. Love, Craig. I would now like to provide you with a brief explanation about the title of this talk. It is not original with me and was decided upon before this talk was written. I was reading an article written during the Republican Party primaries about Pat Buchanan's sister. She is his campaign manager, is Mormon, and has been described as a feminist. She apparently married a Mormon attorney, converted to Mormonism, and has subsequently divorced, but has maintained her membership and apparent loyalty to the church. She is, according to this article, a single mother with primary custody of her two children. The author was commenting on the apparent incongruity of her Mormonism and feminism, and was simply defending the feminism because, according to him, quote, a feminist is a woman who more or less has been mugged by reality, unquote. As Mormon parents of gay children, we too have been mugged by the reality of the lives of our gay children and their attempts to reconcile their same-sex attractions with the broad-based church and societal disapproval. We are viewed by many of our fellow church members as peculiar, as something other than mainstream, as something less than the whole package, as someone of which to be wary, as someone whose opinions are suspect, as someone with whom to commiserate, as someone whose parenting skills are in question, as someone to be treated a little differently than others. We are recognized by most others for what they perceive we are, accidental activists who are doing their best to be supportive parents in a role they hope and pray and fully expect they themselves will never be cast. When our daughter Lori saw the title of my talk in the brochure announcing this program, she expressed some dismay. She immediately interpreted it negatively, assuming from the word mugged that having gay children was similar to taking a beating for a parent. Instead, I'm talking about how the reality of the lives of our gay children has mugged us as parents into a complete overhaul of our own worldviews, our views of what may have been a rather simplistic understanding of good and evil, our views about following the brethren, and yes, even our political party affiliations. At this juncture, I want to make one clarification. I intend for the remainder of this talk to speak frankly about some issues that are deeply meaningful to me. I want to make it clear that these ideas and expressions are mine and not necessarily are espoused or even supported by Family Fellowship. As most of you know, Family Fellowship does not take an advocacy position on any issue and has from its inception tried to promote only love and understanding and respect for all decisions made by those dealing with homosexuality in their families. I would now like to tell you a story. It concerns a songbird and her attempt at migration. It seems she delayed her departure to the south in order to take care of some last-minute details, and as a result, she encountered some unusually cold weather in her flight south. In fact, it got so cold that she became exhausted, froze up from the exposure, and ultimately tumbled from the sky. She landed in a large pasture, no longer able to move, and near death. A cow happened to be by in the vicinity, and as luck would have it, just happened to drop a large cow pie on our beloved but clearly endangered bird. The warmth of the cow pie invigorated the songbird, and she began to feel warm and comfortable. Grateful for her reprieve from imminent death, she burst into song. Unfortunately, a cat was in the vicinity. Upon hearing the songbird's warbling, the cat approached the cow pie and began to clean up the bird. Upon completion of the task, the cat ate the bird. The morals of the story. 1, not everyone who dumps on you is your enemy. 2, not everyone who helps clean up the messes you find yourself in is your friend. And 3, if you're warm and happy, for heaven's sakes, keep your mouth shut. I suppose if we were all warm and happy, I could sit down and spare you the trauma of listening to my ruminations. I will now begin by telling you what I believe about homosexuality this week. 1, that it occurs in a small but finite percentage of human beings and in other mammalian species, that it has always been present and will continue so. 2, its causes are poorly understood. 3, it is rarely chosen. 4, it is not amenable to significant change. By that I mean the same-sex attraction, the core longings, not behavior, which clearly is alterable. And 5, it is morally neutral. Most thoughtful people I know share my belief about 1 through 4, but disagree with number 5. As long as there is generalized ongoing disagreement with number 5, i.e. that it's morally neutral, discrimination and disenfranchisements of gay and lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered individuals will continue. While there is generalized disagreement with number 5, it is by no means uniform. Increasing numbers are beginning to realize that gay people can indeed be moral in their relationships. But the great majority of people who recognize this are hesitant to speak up because they do not want to appear to be at odds with the prevailing moral order. Timur Curran explores this phenomenon at some length in his recent book entitled Private Truths, Public Lies. To maintain acceptance and respect, individuals feel a need to provide evidence that they accept society's basic institutions and share its fundamental objectives and perceptions. We saw this phenomenon at work with the recent lopsided passage of the so-called Defense of Marriage Act. Very few politicians were willing to vote their private preferences, recognizing that a no vote might cost them politically. I've gradually come to the conclusion that the major thrust of our efforts to promote greater understanding of gays and lesbians must center on mainstreaming the reality that they, just like heterosexuals, are capable of moral relationships. I am continually amazed at how much common ground there is with my conservative friends when we discuss homosexuality. Most truly do agree with the first 4 beliefs listed. The problems they see are largely centered on their belief that homosexual behavior is de novo immoral. My partner, Dr. and Mormon Bishop Rod Peterson, a man of great compassion and respect for others, as well as for his church, told me several weeks ago, quote, "I've gradually formed my own impression. I'm satisfied that homosexuality is largely biologic is not often chosen and is not changeable. I'm still uncertain about its expression. Unquote. I had a long telephone conversation with Howard Stevenson, the Republican senator from Draper, who was one of the most outspoken legislators during the recent legislative brouhaha. He basically shares Dr. Peterson's sentiment, but because of his difficulty with number 5, expressed his view that public policy should continue to discourage homosexual behavior. Why? Because most people are uncomfortable with homosexuality. They have been taught that it is wrong. They recognize the difficulties of being gay in our society and church and sincerely want to discourage it as a choice. They don't understand the complexities of being homosexual. They think intuitively that gay people will be happier by repressing their attractions and living as heterosexuals. They believe that sanctioning same-sex relationships will undermine the moral fabric of our society and adversely affect the nuclear family. They simply do not understand that homosexuals are not a threat to the family, that they are family, and that the real threat is people's profound ignorance about homosexuality and their reluctance to face the truth about it. Well, how do we go about making people comfortable with homosexuality? Liberating people from their discomfort with homosexuality, their automatic tendency to think of homosexuals in terms of perverse sex, and their often bizarre notion of who gay people are, what gay people value, and how gay people live is a huge, daunting task. A recent comment made to Andrew Sullivan by Pat Buchanan in a debate epitomizes how many feel. Quote, "Andrew, it's not who you are, it's what you do." Unquote. We must begin first with ourselves. Most of us as parents have similar difficulty with number 5. Let me share a little subtlety that demonstrates how most of us feel and why I think we have to be willing to constantly rethink our positions. We all have a tendency to cling to and promote the idea that choice is not operative in the lives of our children. We all want to emphasize that our children did not choose to be homosexual, that in some way they are the victims of biology. We invited Dr. Roger Gorski to our parent conference earlier this year because we all know intuitively that there is something biologic in our gay children that contributes or has resulted in their same-sex attractions. We are anxious for the scientific community to corroborate these feelings. Why? Are we guilty of the same thing I challenged Representative Bresnahan on earlier this year, trying to find an excuse for our children's or our siblings' homosexuality? To a degree, we are. Why? Because we can't quite get to a comfortable position that same-sex attractions are okay. I used to get incensed when some in the gay community claimed they had chosen to be homosexual. I simply did not believe them, and I saw their statements as being counterproductive. I now recognize why some make such claims. They were way ahead of me. They understood that same-sex attractions were indeed morally neutral, and that they need not apologize for them, whether they were chosen or not. That claiming they had no choice reinforced society's deep aversions, and perhaps our own, to homosexuality, and most importantly, left those aversions in place. These individuals want society to understand that they don't want tolerance because they are victims. Indeed, they see themselves rightly as rational, moral individuals with the right to love whomever they will. They have made it through the morass of anti-gay rhetoric, tradition, and perception, and have arrived at the appropriate position that the morality of relationships is based on the way those relationships are conducted, not on who is involved in the relationship. Who could be critical of a gay relationship that can evoke this line from a recent letter we received from a gay friend who had just begun a committed relationship? Quote, "I'm so happy that I can't even explain it in words. And to think that only a couple years ago I was thinking I had nothing to live for. I'm so happy to have friends like you guys and that I can share this type of news with you." Unquote. I find it so sad to think that news of this type has to be shared so discreetly and that our friend is unable to share the joy of his relationship with his own mother and father. When some try to tell me that gay people can't have a moral relationship, I often think of an old cowboy adage. No matter who says what, don't believe it if it don't make no sense. I find it interesting to ask friends and colleagues when discussing homosexuality if they think it is possible for a gay person to have a moral relationship in this lifetime. Almost everyone hesitates because intuitively it just doesn't make sense to say no. Americans, along with most other people I know, put a high value on being fair. While most have incorporated the perception that homosexuality is wrong into their belief system, they generally haven't given much thought as to what that means to someone who is gay. Their belief system wants to be fair to homosexuals, while at the same time not having to deny their belief that homosexuality is immoral. Bruce Bauer has compared the building of acceptance to homosexuals to teaching a language. Quote, "When gays speak about themselves, they are speaking one language. When most straight people talk about gays, they are speaking another. Most heterosexuals look at gay lives the way I look at a page of German. I may be able to pick out a few familiar words, but I feel awkward when I use them. And if I try to put together a sentence, I'm likely to find myself saying something offensive or hurtful. There's only one way to get past that feeling of confusion: tireless, meticulous dedication to study. You can't learn a foreign language overnight, and you can't teach it by screaming it at people. You teach it word by word until bit by bit they feel comfortable in it and can find their way around in the country where it's spoken." Let me share with you a beautiful short essay written by Bishop Mel Wheatley, Jr. of the United Methodist Church, entitled, "I Do Not Believe Homosexuality is Sin." Quote, "I am an enthusiastically heterosexual male. Is my heterosexuality a virtue, a sign of righteousness, either an accomplishment or a victory of some kind on my part? Of course not. I had nothing whatsoever to do with my being heterosexual. It is a mysterious gift of God's grace communicated through an exceedingly complex set of chemical, biological, chromosomal, hormonal, environmental, developmental factors, totally outside my control. My heterosexuality is a gift, neither a virtue nor a sin. What I do with my heterosexuality, however, is my personal moral and spiritual responsibility. My behavior as a heterosexual may be, therefore, very sinful, brutal, exploitative, selfish, promiscuous, superficial. My behavior as a heterosexual, on the other hand, may be beautiful, tender, considerate, loyal, other-centered, profound. Precisely this distinction between being a heterosexual and behaving as a heterosexual applies to homosexual persons as well, unless you and I are guilty of that lowest blow of all, and that is to work by double standards. Homosexuality, quite like heterosexuality, is neither a virtue nor an accomplishment. It is a mysterious gift of God's grace, communicated through an exceedingly complex set of chemical, biological, chromosomal, hormonal, environmental, developmental factors, totally outside my homosexual friend's control. His or her homosexuality is a gift, neither a virtue nor a sin. What she or he does with their homosexuality, however, is their personal moral and spiritual responsibility. Their behavior as a homosexual may, therefore, be very sinful, brutal, exploitative, selfish, promiscuous, superficial. Their behavior as a homosexual, on the other hand, may be beautiful, tender, considerate, loyal, other-centered, profound. With this interpretation of the mystery that must be attributed to sexual orientation, both heterosexuality and homosexuality, I clearly do not believe homosexuality is a sin. I find his conclusion so interesting and wonder what it is about this particular minister that has enabled him to overcome tradition, prophetic utterances, and biblical references in arriving at his conclusions. In fact, I remember being in Elder Russell Ballard's office approximately 3.5 years ago and expressing to him my own view that the church didn't seem to have a very Christian attitude in its handling of its members dealing with same-sex attractions. He told me at that time that the general authority's hands were, to a large measure, tied by tradition, scripture, and prophetic utterances, and that change would not come quickly. He did not say that change would come, but he did not say that it would not come. And in fact, he made reference to the church's experience with the blacks and pointed out that change was slow but did take place, and alluded to the possibility that policy related to homosexuality might follow a similar course. I intend to digress here for a few minutes and share with you some observations I have made recently that I think are relevant to the subject at hand. I first want to take you to the interview President Gordon B. Hinckley recently had with Mike Wallace. There is a section in the transcript that was of particular interest to me, and I want to quote it directly from the transcript. Wallace: "From 1830 to 1978, blacks could not become priests in the Mormon Church, right?" Hinckley: "That's correct." Wallace: Why? Hinckley, because the leaders of the church interpreted that doctrine that way. Wallace, church policy had it that blacks had the mark of Cain. Brigham Young said, Cain slew his brother and the Lord put a mark upon him, which is the flat nose and the black skin. Hinckley, it's behind us. Look, it's behind us. Don't worry about those little flecks of history. Wallace, skeptics will suggest, well, if we're going to expand, we can't keep the blacks out. Hinckley, pure speculation. Different people will make different interpretations about what President Hinckley really meant. I prefer to see his comments as a general rebuke to previous church leaders in much the same way I see Jesus' good news as a general rebuke to the Old Testament and especially to Moses. The implication to me is clearly similar. That was then, now we have a higher law. That's behind us, and we're not going to look back. Moses has played a pivotal role in the Judeo-Christian belief that homosexuality is immoral. Virtually everything in Scripture concerning the immorality of homosexuality has its origin in the first five books of the Bible, which are generally credited to his authorship. I personally have great difficulty understanding why his writings about homosexuality are accepted so literally by the Judeo-Christian community and our own Mormon church. Most thoughtful individuals, when reading the first five books of the Bible, discount much of what Moses records. Many Latter-day Saints no longer accept the literal interpretation of his accounts of the creation, the flood, the confusion of tongues, or the parting of the Red Sea. We have long since abandoned his statements calling for the death penalty for keeping the Sabbath day holy, or for adultery, incest, fornication, homosexuality, and bestiality. It was Moses who said that God was opposed to interracial marriage, who sanctioned plural marriage, and even went so far as to pronounce the death penalty on animals who were involved in bestiality with humans. We have here a picture of man who is not exactly the epitome of our current concepts of Christianity. We have a picture of man who was literally an eye for an eye kind of person, one who was strongly opinionated, dogmatic, and yes, even vindictive, one that Jesus was correct in gently but firmly rebuking. If asked by a contemporary such as Mike Wallace about these past practices that seemed too severe, too prejudiced, and inappropriate, might Jesus have replied, because Moses interpreted that doctrine that way? Isn't it interesting that so many of our friends, neighbors, and ecclesiastical leaders are so willing to insist that because Moses said homosexuality was an abomination, it is? I suggest it is time to look past Moses. The greater law has superseded much of what took place in the Old Testament. The other morning I awakened rather early and was thinking about this talk. I've been thinking a great deal about the morality of homosexuality, and though it was 4:30 a.m. in the morning, I nudged Millie and said, do you think right and wrong exist independent of God? Does he make these judgments arbitrarily, or is there something else on which he relies? My question does have relevance to the subject at hand. Has God really declared homosexuality immoral? If so, why? What is there inherently immoral in someone loving someone of the same sex? It seems like such a monstrous trick for God to allow such strong feelings to exist in some of our fellow human beings and then provide no sanction whatsoever for them to follow those feelings. No matter who says what, don't believe it if it don't make no sense. Einstein has been quoted as saying, "The most important human endeavor is to strive for morality in our actions." I was thinking about the difficulty in relying on the Word of God as a basis on which to make ethical judgments about appropriate and inappropriate responses to controversial moral questions. Bruce Dahlberg, a religion professor at Smith College, recently had this to say, quote, "Citation of God to back up either side of a debate, whether over private morality or public policy, is to imagine that religious belief is somehow privileged and need not be argued on its own merits in the marketplace. A major discouragement to open discussion and debate is the idea that to settle the question, one merely has to quote God. When we do not discuss in good faith, without prejudice, and without claims to privilege for our views, that is, well, discussion in bad faith. In an almost autistic way, it fails to comprehend that among the believer's opponents are those who also take the Bible seriously, believe in the same God, but precisely from such premises come to different conclusions about morals and public policy. It also ignores the reality that human knowledge of God, however devout, however respected, however biblical, is imperfect and incomplete." Unquote. It's obvious to everyone that different people arrive at different conclusions about what God has said and what he hasn't said. We Mormons are admonished to simply follow the prophet and are promised that he will never lead us astray. In fact, Elder Russell Ballard recently spoke at a BYU devotional and was quoted as saying, quote, "To you I have only one question. Are you going to follow the true and living prophets or not? It really isn't any more complicated than that. We will not lead you astray. We cannot," unquote. When sharing this quote with one of my more irreverent colleagues, he replied, "Aw, shucks, he's too hard on himself." He's simply not giving himself enough credit. The problem is in the word never. What conclusions may we draw from Hinckley's response to Mike Wallace? Some will conclude that in the matter of race, insofar as prophetic leadership is concerned, there may well have been some misinterpretation. The ministry of Christ is viewed by some as a repudiation of Moses' Old Testament philosophy of an eye for an eye. I don't mean to imply for one minute that we should not listen to our prophets. They are generally very wise and are sincerely interested in helping us make correct decisions that will ultimately lead to the greatest happiness. Sensible? Yes. Erudite? Yes. Sincere? Yes. Infallible? Unlikely. If my own search leads me to conclude that homosexuality has the same capacity for morality as heterosexuality, and my church leaders say otherwise, what is my responsibility? Is it permissible for me to dissent? Am I automatically an apostate, or are there others in the church who share my view? Is there room for dialogue? Should I leave the church? Should I stay and voice my conclusions, or stay and keep them to myself? Everyone in this audience has wrestled with these questions. People are obviously going to respond differently depending on their own backpack of experience. I visited just the other day with a colleague of mine, a devout Mormon, with immense intellect about this business of infallibility. I told him that a significant number of parents in our fellowship struggle with that concept and ask for his perception. He told me that certainly mistakes have been made. Generally, this is a church leaders have been preoccupied with more pressing issues and have not taken the time to research and pray about a specific problem. He attributed Brigham Young's comments on race to the fact that race wasn't a burning issue at that time. He was preoccupied with so many other problems that race matters were simply put on the back burner until it became a more relevant issue. Once it resurfaced as a major issue, church leaders made the appropriate adjustment. Unfortunately, some of the statements that were made about race matters when it wasn't a critical issue became codified and made the transition to a correct policy more difficult. I like to think that he has it right. Homosexuality has only become a major concern in the past 20 years. It is in its infancy as a bona fide matter exacting real consideration. Unfortunately, what has been said is codified and will take time to change. This whole business of human rights is in its infancy. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights is barely over 200 years old. Prior to that time, human rights simply did not exist. Make no mistake, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are changing the world. Totalitarian forms of government are gradually crumbling. Respect for all human beings as individuals is on the rise and will not turn back. While the wheels of justice may turn slowly, they are turning. We are gradually becoming a more just, a more understanding people. I want to make it very clear that this is not just a Mormon problem. Catholics, Jews, and to a lesser degree Protestants deal with the question of infallibility and strict obedience as well. Everyone is striving to fashion a correct moral response to this dilemma. Listen to the musings of Andrew Sullivan, a Catholic gay man, about his own struggle to reconcile his homosexuality with his Catholicism. Quote, "It is also a demand that raises the central question of any Catholic homosexual life. How intelligible is the Church's theological and moral position on the blamelessness of homosexuality and the moral depravity of homosexual acts?" Let me read that again. "How intelligible is the Church's theological position on the blamelessness of homosexuality and the moral depravity of homosexual acts?" This question is one I wrestled with in my early 20s, as the increasing aridity of my emotional life began to conflict with the possibility of my living a moral life. The distinction made some kind of sense in theory, but in practice the command to love oneself as a person of dignity, yet hate the core longings that could make one emotionally whole, demanded a sense of detachment or a sense of cynicism that seemed inimical to Christian life. To deny lust was one thing, to deny love was another. And to deny love in the context of Christian doctrine seemed particularly perverse, unquote. I now would like to share with you an email message Millie and I received earlier this year. It demonstrates most poignantly the similar dilemma faced by gay Mormons. Quote, "As many of you know, I started coming out of the closet about a month ago. Since then, I have told my straight housemate, two of my best friends from church, a couple of friends from school, and of course, the wonderful members of Affirmation. I am wondering what your thoughts and personal experiences are regarding coming out to one's bishop and family. My bishop is a sterling guy, loving, caring, and very understanding. I was called to be elders quorum president the same day he was called to be bishop. I served for 2 years and then was called to be the ward mission leader for another year. From the 3 years I met with him in PEC meetings, and from his comments regarding homosexual members of our ward, who still remain anonymous, at least to me, I think he will be understanding. I also have the added advantage, if you want to call it that, of being in a position where the church really can't do anything about my membership. I'm a 32-year-old gay Mormon virgin. That's got to put me in one of the smallest minorities ever. Please, no offense whatsoever is intended toward those of you who may have chosen a different path while still active in your membership. Being gay and Mormon has taught me nothing, if not to judge not, lest ye be judged. If I get excommunicated, it will be because I have asked to be released from my temple covenants, so that I might seek a partner with cleanness of conscience. Again, no offense intended. I'm pretty sure that this is the path I want to take. I don't think I'm strong enough to stay in the church and remain celibate until I die, though I guess that would depend on how long it will be before I get called home. And I don't know that I would really want to, even if I thought I could." Unquote. At present, gay Mormons are faced with a veritable Sophie's choice. Do I choose the child of my church membership or my child of core longings for survival? It's a decision no one should have to make, especially when the child of church membership is supposedly built on a foundation of love. To further quote the writings of Andrew Sullivan, "To dismiss the possibility of a loving union for homosexuals at all, to banish from the minds and hearts of countless gay men and women the idea that they too can find solace and love in one another, is to create an etiolation that no Christian community can contemplate without remorse. These doctrines could not in practice do what they wanted to do. They could not both affirm human dignity and deny human love. To observe these things, to affirm their truth, is not to oppose the church, but to hope in it, to believe in it as a human institution that is yet the eternal vessel of God's love. It is to say that such lives as those of countless gay men and lesbians must ultimately affect the church, not because our lives are perfect or without contradiction or without sin, but because our lives are in some sense also the life of the church." Unquote. In a recent article in the New Republic concerning the efforts of some members of a Jewish synagogue to find a way to sanction same-sex relationships for its gay members, Emily Brazelton is quoted as saying, quote, "But the most important thing about these couples is that they are two Jews committed to being part of the Jewish community. We've got to find a way to make room for them." Unquote. Here are classic examples from Catholic, Mormon, and Jewish perspectives of the horrible conundrum faced by their gay members. I agree with Miss Brazelton. We've got to make room for them. Making room for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered individuals in the church and in society requires a major paradigm shift, but one I'm confident we are capable of making. There's a wonderful new book just published this year entitled The Decent Society. Written by a Jewish philosopher, Avishai Margalit, it is not specifically about homosexuality, but is about the way society and institutions should treat minorities. Margalit talks about the importance of self-respect and honor in the lives of human beings. He describes the decent society as a society whose institutions do not humiliate its members. He defines humiliation as, that is, to the respect a human being deserves for the very fact of being human, unquote. A decent society, he says, is a one that fights conditions which constitute a justification for its dependents to consider themselves humiliated. I found his comments about encompassing groups such as the Mormon Church interesting. Quote, "Belonging to encompassing groups such as the Church is one way that people give their life meaning. Rejection from a legitimate encompassing group is thus liable to be a humiliating act. An encompassing group is a mediating element between the individual and the general society. Such groups are meant to support and elevate the individual, but they may turn out in practice to be oppressive and humiliating. When we evaluate the behavior of encompassing groups, we can distinguish between two dimensions. One is the dimension of voice, i.e., the price an individual in the group pays for criticizing its institution and members. The second dimension is exit, the price the individual pays for leaving the group. Encompassing groups are oppressive when both sorts of price are high, unquote. By his criteria, the church's treatment of its gay members can only be described as oppressive and humiliating, not appropriate in a decent society. The concept of a decent society has a great deal of appeal to me. Too often, we fall far short. There are a plethora of natural causes, including poverty and poor health, for humiliation in our lives without adding humiliation from each other. I want very much to be a member of a decent society. It seems intuitively that the church should be the most decent of all societies. Its treatment of gay and lesbian members, however, leaves much to be desired. When we attended our first conference on homosexuality in 1993, there was a panel discussion about relationships between the church and its gay members. Unquote. I myself have said on several occasions that the most unchristian thing that has happened to me in my lifetime was the excommunication of my son from the church. Why the excommunication? So the church could announce to the world that they abhorred homosexuality and could not and would not allow such individuals to remain members. I still can't understand how allowing gay people in committed relationships to remain members of the church would harm the church. As a point of fact, present policy does considerably more harm. Membership in the church is so important to so many gay members that they try heterosexual marriage, unwittingly dragging a spouse and any children that may result into a maelstrom. The carnage thus produced is simply incalculable. No matter who says what, don't believe it if it don't make no sense. I would now like to spend a few minutes talking about the other aspect of our involvement with homosexuality that I've come to believe is so critical. People are never going to get comfortable with homosexuality until they become acquainted with homosexuals and we, their parents and friends. Some, like me, must be mugged by reality to have their eyes open. Every one of us is at a different stage in our own understanding. We all carry our own backpack of experiences, and that backpack, to a large extent, determines how we respond to the options that are in the marketplace of ideas for us to consider. Those of us with gay children certainly have a different backpack than those who haven't as yet had that experience. Our response to same-sex attractions will differ accordingly. One of our jobs as parents is to articulate our experience and help those not similarly affected to see. In order to do that, we have to be out. We have to be public. We have to be out in every aspect of our lives. People who are not dealing with homosexuality firsthand are going to look around and make their judgments about how they are going to deal with homosexuality based on what they see. As long as we are invisible, as long as we are in the closet, we contribute negatively to what they see. They hear the figures. Some claim that as many as 10% of the population is gay, but they see only a tiny fraction. The fraction that too often have come to resent their disenfranchisement from society and have developed an in-your-face attitude that contributes to the negative perceptions that is out there. How can society ever change their perceptions if they can't see and know people who are homosexual, who are parents and friends of homosexuals, and begin to understand that they too are moral and that they do have and deserve a place in our society? I'm reminded of the story of the football game between the big animals and the little animals. The little animals had been thoroughly dominated by the big animals and were trailing 38-0 at half. When the big animals began the second half from their own 20-yard line, they sent the rhinoceros off right tackle on the first play from scrimmage. When he got to the line of scrimmage, he was met with a bang and down he went. No gain. "Who made that tackle?" queried the rabbit. "I did," replied the centipede. On the second play from scrimmage, the big animal sent the elephant off left tackle. Whop. He was met at the line of scrimmage again. No gain. "Who made that tackle?" asked the rabbit again. "I did," said the centipede. On the third play from scrimmage, the big animal sent the lion up the middle. Bang, down again, no gain. "Who made that tackle?" cried the rabbit again. "I did," replied the centipede. "Where were you in the first half?" said the rabbit. "I was in the locker room lacing up my shoes." Too many gay, lesbian, bisexual people and their parents and friends are still in the locker room lacing up their shoes. We need everyone playing the game. We need everyone making the tackles. It is always easy to find an excuse to rationalize why you couldn't share your personal account with a homophobic relative or friend. Out is better. Take it from someone who has lived it both ways. When you are out, good things happen. People are willing to share their own intimate stories when they realize that you are someone with a sympathetic ear. You no longer need to live in fear that someone will discover your little secret. Too often, someone who will be hurt and not be able to understand why you chose to keep them uninformed. Having an opportunity to hear someone's story and share your own perspective is tremendously rewarding. When Craig and I were featured on Channel 2 last year, I got 3 calls from fellow physicians the next morning thanking me for sharing our story and telling me about a sibling or a child of their own who was homosexual. As members of the informed citizenry, we must work together to first get comfortable with the concept that homosexuals are just as capable of moral relationships as our heterosexuals, and second, be willing to articulate that position publicly. In closing, I want to pay tribute to so many of our straight friends who have stood by us and offered their support and acceptance, to members of our own extended family for their unconditional love. A special thanks most recently to Ed Firmage for his courageous stand on the steps of the Capitol building earlier this year and for the moving account of his own evolution from a position of uninterested, uninformed spectator to an outspoken public crusader. To the parents of Family Fellowship, without you, our lives would be so barren. Thank you for loving, supporting, and making the effort to get solid information on which to make your own judgments about this complex, fascinating phenomenon called homosexuality. I also want to express my deepest disappointment that we don't have more Ed Firmages out there. Too many of our good church members stand by and watch the hurt and anguish inflicted on our gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered brothers and sisters, and we, their parents and friends, by unthinking, insensitive, uninformed individuals. Too many declare for themselves what has been termed an ethical exemption and simply make a decision to not get involved. I think so often of Bob Dylan's lament. How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. To everyone who can hear the sound of my voice, I say, do you hear my people sing, lost in the valley of the night? It is the music of a people who are climbing to the light. They will live again in freedom in the garden of the Lord. They will walk behind the plowshare. They will put away the sword. The chains will be broken and all men will have their reward. For the wretched of the earth, there is a flame that never dies. Even the darkest night will end and the sun will rise. Will you join in our crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Somewhere beyond these barricades, is there a world you want to see? Do you hear my people sing? Say, do you hear that distant drum? It is the future that they bring when tomorrow comes. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through the next part of this. For I, as a gay Mormon centipede, spent far too many years in the locker room trying to find my shoes to lace up. I want, before I attempt to read the response to this paper, I would like to direct a few comments both to you as a gay Mormon centipede who sometimes looks at elephants and wonders if he can make the tackle. I want to make a few comments to you and also to the Strengthening the Members Committee, who I know will hear this tape, that I agree full-heartedly with what Gary says. I feel the hurt as a gay Mormon. I feel that to a great degree the church does not understand. They don't want to understand. And unfortunately, I feel myself slipping further and further away from the church because I will not and cannot give up the deep desire that I have to love somebody. I have no desire to stay celibate for the rest of my life. I don't intend on doing it. But I want to do it, as Gary has brought out, in a very moral way. I say to the members, to strengthen the members' committee, would you please tell President Hinckley that there's a lot of us out here who love the church but feel we've been abandoned, and that if the arms of fellowship were extended, we would embrace them and appreciate them. We pray for understanding. We pray for acceptance. We pray for love. With that said, as a centipede, I'm going to try to read a paper of one who is definitely a rhinoceros on the side of the small animals, of Scott Abbott. I have not had a chance to read this, review this too much since I had a paper this morning, and Scott did not get this to me until last night. So I'll do my best. Anyway, this is what he says. I accepted the invitation to respond to this paper in part because of my admiration for the work Gary Watts has done with Family Fellowship and for his recent public and principled stand during the legislative debates about gay clubs in Utah high schools. Unfortunately, a change in schedule for this session from Saturday to Friday made it impossible for me to be here in person, and so my response will be a written one. The title, Mugged by Reality, is, I think, a fair description of the most common feeling in our homophobic society in response to a revelation of a form of sexuality we have been conditioned to reject. And most of us, when mugged by reality, and I'll add myself to this, fall silent and hope no one will notice. I know that was my case when I discovered that my brother John, a year and a half younger than I, was living with a male lover. It was left for me to discover because John himself had been mugged by reality and, well, versed in our family and social values, was silent about an important part of his life. Many of us fell silent, I think, because we fear the stigma of homosexuality. I've tried to examine my own mixed feelings in this regard, my own reluctance to be identified, even partially, with homosexuality, and have been shocked at the confusion and even the violence of some of my feelings. In 1992, in London, I saw a large stack of new paperbacks called Modern Nature, the journals of Derek Jarman, in a bookstore window. A printed blurb next to the book said that the book, quote, 6 years ago, or said of the book, quote, 6 years ago, Derek Jarman, the brilliant and controversial filmmaker, discovered he was HIV positive and decided to make a garden at his cottage on the bleak coast of Dungeness, or I'm sorry, I can pronounce that, where he also wrote these extraordinary candid journals. End of quote. Having recently lost my brother to AIDS, and otherwise having a scholarly interest in journals as a librarian, or as a literary genre, I immediately wanted a copy of the book. But as I looked at the other books in the window, it was clear that the shop was gay-centered, and I found it impossible for me to enter. Why? because I suppose I feared being associated with, being identified with gay men. Perhaps, heaven forbid, someone might think I was gay. So I went up to the street until I found a more conventional bookstore where I bought a copy of what turned out to be a memorable and remarkable book. For some reason, by some miracle, there are people who, if they fear this stigmatization, I do ignore the fear and step forward to make public statements against the kind of socialization that separates families and communities into more normal and the other, and that then give the other only oppression. To become normal, Gary Watts, to become normal, Gary Watts has done that today, continuing his moral crusade for charitability and enlightened communication between various kinds of good people. My biggest criticism of the paper concerns the issue of Christian supersessionism, the statement that, quote, the greater law has superseded much of what is said in the Old Testament, end of quote. Even the title Old Testament, of course, is an act of supersession. And most scholars of religion now refer to the, quote, Hebrew Bible, end of quote, instead. While it is clearly true that Moses said some things about homosexuality that have made new thinking about, or let me try that again. While it is clearly true that Moses said some things about homosexuality that have made new thinking about it difficult, Paul serves a similar role for Christians. On the issue of Jewish thinkers, Jewish thinkers have been just as regressive and just as progressive as Christian thinkers, and they have done so while largely adhering to the Torah, to the law Christians find so easy to dismiss. But what is the point in passing? I appreciate the non-dogmatic tone as Watts talked about the subject. His beliefs are in flux. Quote, what I believe about homosexuality this week, end of quote, for example. And he is willing to appeal strongly about those beliefs and has argued here most pointedly that homosexuality is normally or morally normal. Does he prove that crucial assertion? I don't think so, other than drawing on the stirring statement by Methodist Bishop Mel Wheatley Jr. and a bit of Andrew Sullivan's argument from a Catholic point of view. But then maybe he doesn't have to prove it. Maybe the weight of proof ought to be on those who claim that homosexuality is not morally neutral. And if you will like a fine argument defending Watts's premise, you could do no worse than to turn to Andrew Sullivan's book. And personally, as Jay Bell, I agree with that. I highly recommend Andrew Sullivan's book. Anyway, back to the paper. Andrew Sullivan's book, Virtually Normal, an argument about homosexuality, published in 1995 by Knopf. I like very much Watts' discussion of his progressive understanding of the necessity of homosexual choice, of not relying solely on biological determination to explain the deviant's behavior, or including it in a wider range of explanation that opens up space for seeing the behavior as morally normal or neutral. I understand the issue because now, I understand the issue better now. Equally important for me were the questions Watts raised as he talked about how different it is to, or how difficult it is to know God, to understand God, to comprehend what it is God wants from us. I admire Gary Watts' optimism about the course of history when he says, quote, "We are gradually becoming a more just, a more understanding people," end of quote. But I wonder if it is true. A more pessimistic feeling is that the opposite is happening as religious fundamentalism gains new power around the world. I hope I am wrong and that he is right. I thank Gary Watts for his thinking and for his activism. And finally, I would like to issue a challenge. I offer $10,000 to anyone who can prove that the kind of discussion Gary Watts is engaged in here will not, in the long run, promote a more healthy, more human society for us all. Thank you.